I want to tell you about a new investigative podcast called She Has a Name. It's about a young mother who disappeared in Detroit in the summer of 1987. She Has a Name tells the story of loss and redemption, mending broken family ties, and facing the trauma experienced by countless individuals who've lost loved ones to violence. Join host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio as they unravel the secrets of what happened to Anita Wiley. You can search for She Has a Name in your podcast app.
This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and this is Cary Jr. II. He is the show's producer. Hey, Cary.
I am this. I don't know what. I don't know.
Right? How did that work?
I don't know how that works at all.
Father's Day is coming up, and we want to have an interesting conversation today about a tough way to be a father. We want to talk with a formerly incarcerated citizen about what it means to maintain that relationship between a father and a son from behind bars.
Yeah, we're going to talk with Tory Price, who was incarcerated two times. He suffers from substance abuse disorder, and so he's been in jail twice. The second term, he went for 10 years, and it was right after he had a son. And so he talks about how that impacted his ability to parent, the resources he received at the time. But he was released last year in 2023, currently a public speaker and educator, and he works currently for the Michigan Collaborative to End Mass Incarceration. And he's now an advocate for a proposed legislation called Second Look, which is a way for folks who have served or are sentenced to serve 10 or more years to get reevaluated to see if they should be released at around that 10-year mark. So that they can be reunited with their families.
Yeah, he is advocating not only for the conditions and the inspiration while someone is behind bars to make and maintain that relationship with a child, but also when they come out, right? 80% of people who go to prison will come back someday to their community. And if they are parents, that means they come back to that primary relationship. How do you do that? How do you prepare people for that? How do you make sure that they feel comfortable and feel confident in the way that they can re-enter society through that parenting relationship?
Yeah. So Tory Price joins us on this episode to talk fatherhood, incarceration, and this proposed legislation, Second Look.
Tory Price, welcome to Created Equal. It's great to have you here. I want to start by talking about the idea of fatherhood and mass incarceration. It's actually an issue I've known quite a bit about for some time. There are a number of inmates who I've gotten to know, people who are incarcerated here in Detroit and in the state. And we've had lots of conversations about what it's like to be a parent in those situations. And I think most people who have maybe never been to prison really have no idea how difficult and how many things get complicated by that. But I want to start with you just talking about that experience, what it was like being a father while serving time.
Stephen, thank you very much for having me here. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to share my story. When I left my son, he was 2 years old. And I was looking at 10-year sentence. In fact, the 10 to 30 had to do at least 10. And it was so far to look out that far, to think that I won't come home until he's 12 years old. How will I parent? How can I parent? Will him, myself and his mom be able to have a relationship in order for me to see him on a regular basis? Mm-hmm. All of this going through my head when I looked at 10 years. It's not easy. You know, there were some things that I needed to correct. So I took a parenting class. I was one of the first classes that I took was a parenting class so I could communicate better with him and I could communicate better with his mom. And then the first visit, June of 2014, was absolutely wonderful. I hadn't seen my son in 18 months, and I thought he'd forget who I was.
Yeah.
That first visit, getting down on my knees and him running to me and saying, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." At that moment, I had hope that I would be able to get through this time, but also continue to be a parent.
Yeah, yeah. And so from that initial kind of point where, all right, I'm going to do this, right? He's gonna come see me here, and I'm going to parent from here. Talk about how you build that relationship, right? It obviously looks different than it would if you weren't where you were. How do you even begin?
You know, there was a— because I took that parenting class, Macomb Correctional Facility had this awesome program. It's called Daddy and Me. Mm. And my son was able to come up twice a month for about an hour, hour and a half. The caregiver, his mom, would stay in the waiting room, and my son would come back, and we would visit together one-on-one. It would be myself and about three other fathers. They would move all the chairs, and they would bring in footballs, baseballs, basketballs. That's where I taught my son how to throw a baseball. And those visits really helped me have that relationship. Mm-hmm. Because other visits, when they came in on a Sunday, you had this huge visiting room with so many people, not child-friendly, you know, telling a 2-3-year-old to sit in a chair, to stay still. Right. It's very difficult. But when he was able to move around and we were able to run around that visiting room, that's when our bond really started. We do arts and crafts, make Mother's Day cards for his mom. Mm-hmm. They would even ask me what kind of gift I want for him for his birthday, for Christmas. So when he came in, he had a gift to unwrap.
Yeah.
That began to normalize that parenting, that father and son relationship that he was able to see from his friends, right? My dad's giving me gifts.
Right.
My dad's playing with me. So even in that being behind those fences— that program allowed for me to begin that, I'm going to say, normal as it could with the circumstances.
Sure.
Correct.
That's so important. You know, I can remember as a young kid, and I had a father who had a number of different problems and suffered with addiction and all kinds of things. And I can remember how it felt when I was young that my dad was different from everybody else and that my relationship with my dad was different than what I saw my friends, for instance, have with their dads. And so that idea of trying to normalize it, especially under the circumstances that you were facing, I can imagine is just that's everything.
Yes. That gave me that, you know, it's so hard in an oppressed situation to daily find that hope. You know, yes, prayer, yes, journaling. But when I had those visits to look forward to, and my son was excited about it, man, that took me over the top. And I didn't want to mess that up. So guess what? I was the quote unquote model
right.
incarcerated person.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't want to get in any trouble
yeah.
because I didn't want to lose these moments with my son.
Yeah,
and those moments were precious.
Yeah, let's talk about what led you to be incarcerated. It happens to you a number of times in your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
What put you on that path?
So I've suffered from a substance use disorder. In fact, it started with a gambling addiction, and it just moved from gambling to drugs because I never took care of it, right? Mm-hmm. I never faced it head on. I just tried to run. I tried to run from the trauma. I tried to run from my adverse childhood experiences. I tried to just get away. And the gambling and the drugs never helped. But what they did do was that, you know, I got into some decision making that was wrong. Mm-hmm. And so it led me to robberies to fuel that addiction. Mm-hmm. So I've done a total of 17 years of my life, 48 in prison, this last one being 10 years. Mm-hmm. So it has been a lifelong struggle. But I tell you, Stephen, where I'm at today, I feel like I am at the best mental, physical, spiritual health that I have been in my entire life.
Substance use disorder, that's not something I think most people maybe are used to hearing, that term, or right. having it described that way.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So it's most people would hear addict, mm-hmm. right? Alcoholic, mm-hmm. Drug addict. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a drug addiction, and I choose not to use those words for me. That's a form of labeling. For me to look at them in the mirror every day and say I'm an addict, mm-hmm. It to me perpetuates that situation versus. Looking at it from a medically standpoint in a disease and substance use disorder. And I can accept that because when I accept that and look at it, you know, I look at, you know, cancer patients and at the when they're cancer free to get the ring of bell.
Yeah.
So when I look at substance use disorder, although it's never over, what I can say today, I can ring a bell every day that I'm sober. And that's what I do. And that's the way I frame it and look at it because, you know, the word addict, it just doesn't fit for me. Mm. So I have substance use disorder and I'm a person in recovery.
Yeah. When you were incarcerated, was there help for that or did that make it easier to kind of continue in that life?
So a couple of things, you know, there's a lot more drugs in prisons than a lot of people.
I was going to say that a lot of people say, look, I can become it's easier to be an addict in prison in some cases.
Absolutely. Several drug overdoses at Macomb Correctional Facility. I've seen people go down, you know, heroin, fentanyl, but they did. They had Narcotics Anonymous and AA, as mm-hmm. well as a Christian 12-step program, Celebrate Recovery, and then Next Step Christian Recovery. So there was programs available, also therapists as well, if you'd like to see a therapist. So there. But what I was told was when I initially saw one was that there was no need for a therapist. I just need to go to meetings, mm-hmm. And so. I did. I went to as many meetings as I could go to that were offered because I didn't want to continue the life that had led me to prison many times.
Yeah. And was your son part of the motivation for that as well to get clean while
absolutely.
You were incarcerated?
You know, my son didn't see any. He was so young, right? He didn't see the terror, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't see all the bad decisions. This was an opportunity for me, you know, to come home at an age where, you know, I knew that I needed my father. So I needed to be right mentally and spiritually and on the right track to be a present father for him. You know, we had started a great relationship inside and I wanted to continue that when I came home.
Yeah. When you think about the support for not just substance abuse help, but also for fatherhood inside our correctional facilities, how much support is there? How easy is that? I mean, it sounds like a journey that just. It would have felt impossible, I guess, at times without some support. So how much was there?
So if I didn't have my family support, if the program that that came in brought the Daddy and Me program, and mm-hmm. Macomb Correctional Facility was the only one in the state. And then, too, if I wasn't close mm-hmm. to home, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have the relationship I have with my son because there's absolutely no support. The parenting class was not a Michigan Department of Corrections class. It was a class by Oakland Livingston Human Service Agency, right? So if they didn't bring it in, there wouldn't have been a parenting class and those visits wouldn't have existed. And I'm just so thankful that I stayed close. So many Detroit parents are up north.
Yeah.
6 hours away from home.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know how you keep a family together that far away. So being 35, 40 minutes from home, such a blessing, and I'm just grateful that I had that.
That made a difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. When you were released, your son was how old?
When I was released, my son was 12.
12.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So talk about what that was like.
You know.
I mean, he's two when you go away.
Yeah.
He's 12 when you get out.
Oh, man. The day he didn't know. He didn't know I was coming home. The day I came home, we did that purposely. He was in school. He wanted to get out of school, so we said, "No, you stay in school." So I was at a Starbucks, and I came out of the bathroom, and he was just looking at me. He didn't even know it was me. He kept looking at me up and down, and I'm like, "Hey!" And he's like, "Dad,
what are you doing here?" Right?
Right. He was like, "It can't be my dad. He's not supposed to be home yet." But that day was incredible. Just to hold him. And to know that I didn't have to go back to my room. Mm. I didn't have to go back to my cell after seeing him. You know, that he could stay with me it's not even big enough, right? The word to describe that feeling.
Yeah.
And you know, his mom called me a Disney dad. Last summer, she said I was a Disney dad, right? Went to all of it. He plays travel ball, you know, high level travel ball, and he's very good. And so I get to watch his games.
What does she mean by Disney dad?
Like I everywhere I could take him, I took him.
Oh,
right,
I
had a friend at Grand Haven. He has a boat. We went out there. We went up.
You do all the fun things,
right? So she said, you know, you just came in. You just came in and swooped him up and did everything fun. You know, indoor water parks. You know, we had a special bond during the summer of 23, and every moment was special, and our relationship grew. I mean, it took off, and it almost, when I came home, it was because of those visits, because of the seeing him at four times a month, talking to him on the phone. It was a smooth transition for me, and it's just not like that for most fathers that's incarcerated.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Tory Price about second look legislation, which we're going to get to next, and the idea of fathers, fatherhood, incarceration, and how we make all that work. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Back with more Created Equal, and we're talking with Tory Price, who's a public speaker, educator, advocate, and a formerly incarcerated person. He is someone who is advocating for second look legislation, which we're going to talk about in just a little bit. But before we get there, Tory, I want to talk about what you do now after you've been incarcerated. You come home and try to make things better for the people you left behind in some ways. Why?
Oh, why? You know, I develop relationships with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the conditions. And I've seen the changes in people, the transformations that has happened. And I said to myself, and I told them that I want to be an advocate. And I took a class, it's called Inside Out Prison Exchange Program, where 15 college students from University of Michigan Dearborn came inside and had 15 inside students, incarcerated students, and we had a sociology class for a semester.
Mm.
That class, you know, I played college soccer, I've been in the Marines, right? I have not felt a sense of belonging until I took that class. And in that class, I seen how the systemic oppression, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna do things differently. I'm gonna change who I am. And that's when I truly became an advocate. So I was advocating inside. So the opportunities that I had to, when I came home, I wanted to do that. And so today I'm the program coordinator for Michigan Collaborative to End Mass Incarceration. And we take folks out of silos, right? We take organizations out of silos and we bring them together in coalitions to say, let's attack a bill, let's attack a situation, sentencing, rather sentencing, reentry, programming inside, and let's go after it together. Mm-hmm. Because we know that there's more resources when we come together as one than if one organization is doing it by themselves.
Yeah. When you were in incarcerated, I mean, obviously you saw a number of different needs for other people who were in the same situation. I wonder what needs you saw for other fathers and fathers who maybe didn't have the same kind of centering or motivation that you seem to have to try to maintain that relationship. Talk about what that looks like on the inside of the correctional facility.
You know, one of the biggest situations is the caregiver.
Yeah. Right?
The father and the mother. Uh-huh. The father and the grandmother. Mm-hmm. That disconnect is one of the biggest barriers for folks being able to be a parent inside. What I had to do was humble myself. What I had to do was say, you know what, I made these bad decisions. And so the folks inside need to say and need to have opportunities and platforms. Like, there's no more parenting classes. Where do they learn these skills to be able to change the communication between themselves and the parent of their child? Because I knew that my son's mom had full control.
Mm.
And I knew that if I communicated with her in a bad and a way, the way I was doing prior to being incarcerated, nothing was going to get done. So that relationship had to be repaired. That relationship had to be level in order for me and my son to have a relationship. And that's one of the biggest barriers for folks inside.
Yeah.
It's just there's no connection and no the skills and ability to be able to communicate better with the caregiver that's outside. That's what I saw. And then again, that travel, I mean, guys would come to Macomb and say, man, I haven't been down in the Detroit area for 5, 6, 7 years.
Wow.
You know, so how do you connect?
Well, how do you?
It's through the phone. Yeah. Through, you know, so we have the phone, right? We have 15-minute phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
We have a system called JPay where you can send messages.
I'm really familiar with JPay.
Unfortunately, yeah. Right? And so
it's not the most benevolent way of letting people communicate.
It is not. Yeah. It is not. But I'll tell you, I loved pictures coming in.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, to be able to see pictures coming in, and I have this tablet and these digital pictures, and I could lay in my bed and look at my family and have that hope.
Mm-hmm.
So although it's not the best situation, you know, I took advantage of all opportunities. And so the connection, so JPay telephone, but that just doesn't get to the point where we truly can be parents.
So at Michigan Correctional Facilities, state facilities, there wasn't any physical contact, right? With your child if they come visit.
Yeah. So there is. So if you're in a level, if you are level 1, 2, and 4, right, you can have contact.
You
right?
do.
You do.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, they come in when you can hug them when they first come in, mm-hmm. and they're sitting right next to you. So, you know, you can put your arm around them.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate part was when my son, up until the age of 5, your child can sit on your lap, right? And then all of a sudden, at the age of 6, they cannot. So
it's hard for them, right?
So he's like, why can't I do this anymore, right? So those types of things, you know, it's not kid friendly. So MDOC does have contact visits if you're in those levels, level 5, or if you're in any kind of segregation, then you're having to visit behind a wall,
you're
behind
separated.
A window. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking the reason I asked that, I'm thinking about the ways in which the prison or the jail is organized around the idea of maintaining that relationship or not. I mean, that's not their primary job, right? We can all, I think, agree on that.
Mm-hmm.
But if the idea is, look, people come here, they stay for a time, and they leave, they go back to a community, I think that, you know, the priority list looks a little different, or it should. And this seems like something that, I don't know, should be higher on that list. How do we make sure that the people who are here can parent while they're here, but even more importantly, become better parents when they leave?
You know, really, honestly, there needs to be a family reunification program, and a comprehensive one. And it starts, again, with parenting classes. And it starts with the type of visits I had all over the MDLC needs mm-hmm. to have those kind of visits.
Mm-hmm.
And then 6 months or so prior to coming home, the caregiver and the parent start coming in and having visits with a counselor, with the incarcerated person, with the incarcerated parent. Mm-hmm. And you don't even have to be in a relationship with a caregiver, but you're building relationships so that you can co-parent when they come home.
Right.
Right. That is what needs to happen. And then when you leave, still have those counseling sessions in order, because it is a huge transition from being incarcerated, oppressed, to coming out here and everything is open. So that's what needs to happen, Stephen. And you know, there's some programs in the works,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I hope the planning does work and they come out. But there are some organizations that are trying to get a family reunification program in Michigan Department of Corrections.
Yeah. How hard was it for you to maintain the things that you figured out while you were incarcerated? Once you were back, once you were no longer, you know, restricted from doing anything, mm-hmm. No longer separated physically, how much discipline did that take?
A lot.
Yeah.
It is. You go from not having the ability. I mean, first of all, they tell you when to eat. You know, all meals are prepared.
Right.
To now, I have to find my own food. I have to cook my own food. You know, just simple things. You know, my first two nights, I could not even sleep with the light off. Okay. I was so used to sleeping with the lights
on,
some kind of lighting, that I could not fall asleep. You know, so there is a huge transition. And then waking up every day and saying, okay, I got to plan my day, right? My day isn't planned by someone. I have to plan it. It takes a lot of work, a lot of transformation. And I took the assault of offenders class, I took substance abuse class, the parenting class, Inside Out Prison Exchange program, anything. I took culinary arts. So all of those programs for me, especially the culinary arts program, empowered me to say, mm-hmm. you know what? I can do it. I have the ability, and this is how I can do it. So yes, discipline. And I tapped into to things I learned in the Marine Corps as well,
mm-hmm.
For the first time in my life, and was able to maneuver a schedule and get around. Then I had a lot of support, a lot of support.
Yeah. When you go back now to prisons or jails and talk with or interact with the folks there, what are the things that sort of pop out at you that they're struggling with in terms of the parenting dimension of this, the things that that maybe they just can't get it right?
So unfortunately, right now, I don't get to go inside.
You don't get to go.
No, I don't, but I do talk
to them. Is that because you're
So I'm formally still on papers. So because I'm still on parole, yeah. I don't get to go. Eventually,
You'll
be able to do that. With my job and being an advocate, I will be able to go back inside. And it's going to be on a facility-by-facility basis.
Sure.
So the warden says, you know what? You know, I'll get approval through Lansing, and then each warden will have the say so. But I do talk to a lot of parents who are inside,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have a relationship with their child now. And one of the key factors is the relationship with the parent.
Yeah, you were saying that.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's just so hard to imagine that mm-hmm. Even after you're incarcerated, that continues, that you don't have a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because no skills were given. No skills were given, and there's no support. I mean, Michigan Department of Corrections says they're about family connection, because statistics show that when someone has a connection with family, the chances of them going back to prison are lowered.
Right.
And so if that's the case, what is not happening?
Uh-huh.
Right? Why is it not happening? Why isn't there more of a robust plan from MDLC to make parenting easier and to keep these family connections?
Yeah, yeah. The programs that are available to people inside, do they make those easily accessible? Do they make it – or they make it hard for you to figure out how to do that while you're doing the other things that you got to do in prison?
So here's the thing. If you're doing a life sentence, it is very hard to get into programs.
Is it?
Oh, yes, unfortunately.
Why is that true?
The MDLC likes to look at folks who have about 3 to 4 years left before going home.
I see.
Before they start putting them into
like preparing them to—
Correct. Absolutely. So it's a little bit more difficult for those people who are serving life sentences. Now, there are volunteer programs, right? There are programs like the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program, like NAAA. Those are things that anyone can sign up
mm-hmm,
for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to be at certain levels, right? If you're on a level one, level two, you have all these programs available. The higher levels, you don't have all the programs available,
right,
because of security classification.
Yeah.
So if you're in a level four up, you know, you're going to have to wait, unfortunately, until your security level drops, and then you have a lot more opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking with Torrey Price. We're going to hear about the Second Look program that he's working on. Stay where you are. We'll be back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined us. We're talking with Torrey Price. He's a public speaker, an educator, an advocate, a formerly incarcerated person. He advocates for people who are locked up here in the state of Michigan for better programming and support for them, and of course, for them to have better success once they're no longer incarcerated. Torrey, I want to talk about Second Look, which is something you've really been focused on. What is Second Look?
Second Look legislation allows folks that are inside who have done long, and we call them long indeterminate sentences, right? Mm-hmm. Because you get a minimum of 10.
You get a range.
Right, correct. And or life.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them an opportunity to show that they have transformed, and they get to petition to their judge and say, hey, this is what I've done since I've been incarcerated. Give me a second look.
Mm.
Give me a second chance.
At my sentencing.
At sentencing, correct. And so they'd be able to petition a judge. The judge then looks at the information and says, you know what, I want to take a look at this. So they go in front of the judge, and they let them know how they've changed. And then the judge has an opportunity to change their sentence. So if someone's serving a 20-year sentence and they're at 15, and the judge says, you know what, I see the changes you've made,
mm-hmm,
and I believe that you're ready to go back to society, he then can change his sentence. But then the person still has to go in front of the parole board before they're actually released.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a case-by-case basis. But, you know, we believe in second chances. And when I tie it to my story, I did 10 years this
mm-hmm
last time.
Mm-hmm.
And the transformation that I was able to make and what I'm giving to society today, there's so many folks inside that have that same opportunity.
You know, there's so many people who I think doubt that. Right. I think if you talk to most people about the criminal justice system, they believe that the people who are in belong there and belong there for as long as we can keep them. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why that's not the way to read it.
Well, most folks, number one, age out of crime.
Yes.
It's just statistics show that they age out of crime.
Right. I'm not going to do the same things at 40 or 50 that I might have done at 15 or 25.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then here's the piece. The person's going to get out.
Right. So most people do not serve life.
So they're gonna get out at one point. So why not get them at the point where they are at the peak of their transformation, where they're saying, you know what, this is what I've done. These are the programs I've taken mm-hmm. to change my life. And you know what, my family is still there. My family is still there waiting for me. My family. So I'm connected. I have people that are waiting for me. I have a support team. Then in 5 more years, when that support team may not be there, mm-hmm. guess what? They're still coming home. So when you look at when we look at public safety is about putting people back into the community when they are ready, when they have the tools, when they have the bonds, when they have the skills to continue as citizens. 80% around 80% of people in Michigan are going to come home one day.
Are coming home at some point. Yeah.
So let's support them where they're at their best and bring them home.
Well, and another way to think about that really is where we started this conversation with, which was with parenting. What are the chances that a child who grows up without a parent because they're incarcerated finds their way to trouble themselves, right? Probably higher than if that parent were back and home, even if they'd made a mistake and were incarcerated. That influence breaks the cycle, or at least has a better chance to break the cycle.
Stephen, my father was incarcerated.
Is that right?
Right. So my father was incarcerated. My brother was incarcerated.
Wow.
I was incarcerated. And so when you look at that, how do I break the cycle now?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the programs that I took, the same thing for these fathers who have a chance for a second look, who would have a chance for a second look if this legislation is passed, will have an opportunity to break that cycle because they are able to get to their children at a younger age and not 22. Right. So, you know, I have a friend, his daughter's 13. He won't be home for another 9 years.
Wow.
But he would qualify for second look because of all the programs he's taken. He can be in his daughter's life right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that will give her an opportunity to live, and he can break that cycle. And so it helps her mental health. And that to me is safety. That's community safety. When we have connections and family, and stopping the cycle of addiction, stopping a cycle of incarceration, that's community safety.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about what the criteria would be. You said people who have served long sentences. How specific are you about that? And is there an age dimension of this as well?
So the bill that was initially submitted was 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So 10 years or more.
10 years or more, right, up to a life sentence. That was the initial bill that was submitted. And then you would be able to petition at that point, no matter how many years was on your sentence, mm-hmm. as long as you've done 10. There is no age limits or, you know, it doesn't matter your age. It clearly is just on the sentence that you have
right.
that you're serving.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we should also add a little context for people to understand. Michigan's a weird state with criminal justice and sentencing. I always say it's kind of hard to go to prison in Michigan, right? You kind of have to do a lot of things before they decide you are going to prison. But once they do, you stay a long time, right? We're terrible at letting people serve a portion of their sentence and then come out. I mean, once you're in, you're in.
Yeah. All the other states in the Midwest have something called good time.
Good time. We don't have that.
No, we do not. Yeah. Michigan has the largest or the longest serving sentences in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
and it's costing taxpayers money.
Right, right. We spend $3 billion a year on criminal justice. By the way, we only spend about $1.5 billion on education, but that's another conversation.
Yes, it is.
But I don't think those two things are unrelated. But people stay a long time, and the thought behind that is, well, you know, I mean, there's a punitive aspect of it, but I think there's also a thought that, well, if we keep them there longer, they're less likely to come back and reoffend. But that doesn't always work that way.
It doesn't. And so my question would be, if that's the case, then why aren't other states doing the same sentencing as Michigan?
Right. And why don't we have lower crime rates than those states?
Correct. And so it's not what the thought is it matching up to what's happening? And then there's another piece to the second look, and that is the staffing at Michigan Department of Corrections. These officers are doing doubles every day, mandated doubles.
Wow.
So if second look passes and more people are released, it's a safety factor inside. Because when officers are working long hours, they are not the same as if they only work 8. I mean, they're not on their toes. So we're looking at a safety factor, and we're looking at officers. There was an officer wrote an op-ed in the Metro Times about that.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of time they're
working.
Right. And the safety, and then they want to be home with their families too. So, you know, looking at it from so many different aspects, second look is a good idea for the state of Michigan.
If this law had been in place for you, would it have meant anything?
It wouldn't have helped me
because you had 10.
Yeah, because I had 10.
Yeah.
Because I had 10, it wouldn't have helped me. But when I look at the opportunities, when I look at the opportunities that are given, that are there,
mm-hmm.
For folks to make that transition and change, man, it would open so many doors for so many deserving people.
Yeah. Yeah. Where does the legislation stand now, and what are the next steps?
Right now, we are it had a hearing earlier this year. We are trying to get another hearing and to to get it through the CJ forum, and that. That's where it's at now.
Mm-hmm.
But we are rallying troops. We are rallying constituents and troops to get to these coffee hours of legislators. And a lot of them don't know the information. So we are out there getting the information out to how much money the MDOC in the state of Michigan would save under second look.
Yeah. I want to go back to fatherhood before we have to And your relationship with your son Cooper, we should say his name, right?
Yeah.
What are your goals for that relationship, and what are your goals for him now that you're home?
So for the relationship, you know, I grew up in a single mother home,
mm-hmm.
And my goal for Cooper is to have the best two parents. Co-parenting at the same time with the same goals of loving, caring, and supporting.
Mm.
My biggest thing with Cooper is, what do you want to do and how I can be there to help you? Not what I want him to do. Now, I did send him to Michigan basketball camp last year, and I was living vicariously through him with that. I bring him into, you know, I co-facilitate a class at U of M, and I bring him to class for him to talk about being a child of an incarcerated parent.
Hmm.
And so I want him to embrace, not be afraid to say where his father was, but to embrace it. And so people can see that even though there was challenges, even though his dad was gone for 10 years, there's still opportunities. You know, I want to see him go to college. He wants to be a baseball player. He doesn't know what he wants to do educationally yet, though.
That'll come.
And I'm not, again, I'm here to support him, and yeah. I want to meet him where he's at.
He's 13, right?
13, yeah. And he wants to play
It'll
ball.
It'll be a while, right? Yeah, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. And play it. And, yeah. And so his mom and I support him in becoming the best ball player he can be, the best student, respecter of people. He's a really grounded child. With all the things that I put him through with my incarceration, to see him where he's at, I'm really proud of him.
One of the things I love about the way you talk about that is that it reminds me of something that I say all the time about parenting. And that's that it's a lifelong exercise, right? Once you have this human being that you've helped to create, there is no end. And all of us make mistakes. We do things that we probably shouldn't have done. Sometimes we do things that, we knew we shouldn't have done and we did them anyway. But there's no such thing as ruining that relationship. There's no such thing as ending that relationship. Every day you have the opportunity to go back and to fix what got broken and to make the relationship what you both need it to be. And I think that too often people feel defeated in that relationship, right? I screwed up, so I can't fix it, right? I'm incarcerated, so that means it's over. That's never, ever true.
No. And you know what really helped me with that? I'm 48 years old, and the connection I have with my mom is what fueled that, right? My mother never gave up on me.
Right, right.
She was there by my side. And so I took that and what she gave me, and I said, you know what? Yep, I did these things. Cooper doesn't have to. I did these things. I can teach him what not to do. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, I'm going to go back to it. I just want to be there where he needs me to be, right? That's it.
That's all it is.
What do you need today? Yeah. Not just money, right? But
not just, right?
But you know, how can I support you in what you want to do, and how can I lift you up?
You don't have to be a superhero, and I think too many of us think that's the standard, and if you're not meeting it, you're failing, and that's just not right.
And it's unfortunate because you don't. My son, when he was five, called me a superhero, right? He doesn't think I'm a superhero today.
That's right.
He knows I have flaws, but you know what? He loves me just the way that I am.
Yeah. What are you guys doing for Father's Day?
Oh, man. You know, he has a baseball tournament that weekend.
Takes precedence, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The baseball. So what we'll do is we'll actually do some on the 15th, the day before. He does have a couple games, but we'll be able to slide in some barbecuing during that time, because Sundays, you never know, right? If they're going to the championship, they may have game after game after
they
game.
They might be there all day.
They may be all day. So we're going to do something on 50. I love the grill.
Yeah.
I learned some skills while I was inside. So some steaks and shrimp and some salmon on the grill, and we'll have a good time.
Yeah. Well, enjoy it. And thanks so much for joining us here on Created Equal.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that was a really nice conversation you had with Tori. You identified with what it takes to be a valuable father and how his circumstances can sometimes make that more complicated than it already is.
The thing that I always want to emphasize is, again, parenting is a lifelong thing. Mm-hmm. And making a mistake, you make mistakes, keep at it. And Tori's a great example of that, right? I think, again, incarcerated people have more challenges than any other parents do, really. And when they overcome them, it's something that you just have to take inspiration from.
I got the opportunity to speak to his son, Cooper, really briefly. He spoke to me after school, and we wanted to include a little bit of his voice of him talking about his dad and kind of what it was like for him. So here's what he had to say. Just what do you remember, first off, from your dad being incarcerated? What do you remember from that experience?
I remember the long drive, mm-hmm. and going there a couple times a month and waiting there for around 15 minutes and having to get like patted down and everything, making sure it's safe, and going in there. Usually we ate and we just played board games and just talked. I understood that I was different because I would see people at parks and stuff, and I would see, one time I saw a little kid on dad's shoulders, and I got really sad because I realized I wouldn't be able to have it till I was 12. And I just remember going to my games and seeing my other friends' dads there, and you're always wishing that my dad was there too. I wasn't mad at him at all. I was mostly just excited to see him, and I was sad because I couldn't really see him that much. But when I got to see him, I was really happy.
Any plans for Father's Day?
I'm hoping to just see him and get to spend some time with him.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's all that you really need. That's the 13-year-old Cooper.
Yeah. Like, sounds like every other 13-year-old I know. When he's talking about his dad, right?
Right. He was just happy to see him.
So. Yeah, just happy to see him. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lyons. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.